We are talking today with Max Blumenthal. Max Blumenthal is an award-winning journalist and blogger whose articles and video documentaries have appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times, The Daily Beast, The Nation, The Huffington Post, Salon.com, and Al Jazeera English. He is a senior writer for The Daily Beast and a writing fellow for The Nation Institute, and he is here to talk about his new book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Max, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
It's great to be here.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Republican Gomorrah?
Well, I've been covering the radical right, especially the Christian right, for 6 years, and I just wanted to package all of my reporting, including all the videos I've shot at Christian right events, all of the investigative reporting I've done on movement leaders and followers and organizations into this book, and to provide, you know, a historical arc that explains where the movement came from and how it took over the Republican Party and shattered it, drove it to the margins outside the mainstream of the American electorate. And beyond that, I wanted to kind of offer an analysis of the mindset of the movement, the sensibility of the movement, because I've spent so many hours covering it. I developed an understanding, I think, of what drives the movement followers and leaders on an individual level, and I think it hasn't been, although some authors and academics have hinted at it, I don't think they really were able to capture the mindset, and so I wanted to at least attempt it and offer this analysis just as a series of observations and not as the answer or the catch-all to what drives the movement. But so far, people who have come out of this movement have, for example, Frank Schaeffer, whose father is the godfather of the Christian right, one of their intellectual godfathers, has told me, I nailed it.
And you have, in fact, become friends with Frank Schaeffer, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, he's a friend, and he's written 2 reviews of my book, very favorable reviews. And, he's a prophetic figure. I guess to talk about his father, Francis Schaeffer is a major figure in my book. He was running in the 1960s a hippie commune for Christians in the Swiss Alps called La Brie. It was a very tolerant environment, and he would give these all-night lectures on how John Cage and Pablo Picasso and modernism fit into, Christian doctrine and the modern age. And so he was drawing a massive audience of, young evangelicals who called themselves Jesus freaks, and people like Timothy Leary, the LSD guru, would come and visit him. Jimmy Page, the guitarist for Led Zeppelin, was seen with a copy of one of Schaeffer's books in his back pocket. I mean, Bono from U2 today says Schaeffer's early work is comprised some of his favorite books. But with the Roe v. Wade decision, Schaeffer was radicalized. He believed the United States had just legalized infanticide, essentially death panels. And so he went to Washington and began evangelizing the Republican leadership, the Ford administration, and the Republicans in the Senate, who were still comprised of moderates, on the importance of opposing abortion and the danger of abortion. And he at the same time met with Jerry Falwell, this preacher from Virginia who had been primarily preoccupied with opposing racial integration of his so-called private Christian schools. Paul Weyrich, the Catholic right operative, had gone down to Virginia to try to convince Falwell to stop with the racial stuff and get involved in abortion, and he said, we couldn't get him or any of the guys around him interested. But Schaeffer did it. Schaeffer was very gifted, and he told Falwell, let's use the tactics of Martin Luther King to unravel the secular establishment, to attack the underpinnings of secular society. And they wound up forming the Moral Majority together, which is the group that, provided the grassroots support for Reagan in 1980, and Reagan told them, I know you can't endorse me, but I endorse you. What wound up happening, though, was towards the end of Schaeffer's life, he became frustrated with the failure to overturn Roe v. Wade and the failure to stop abortion and began advocating domestic terrorism, what he called force in the defensive posture. And Frank Schaefer told me, you know, if my father was a black man, he would have been immediately imprisoned. But instead, we were hanging out with Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. As Schaefer got cancer, 1985, he was laying dying, and he wanted to. He saw the movement that he helped build become primarily concerned with power and money, and also become extremely homophobic. He hated homophobia, and he wanted to denounce the Christian right, but it was too late. He died, and so it was left to Frank Schaefer, his son, who you know, many in the Christian right were encouraging to continue his father's empire, to come out against this movement. And he's done so. He's been all over the place on, you know, any cable news program or radio show you can think of, denouncing Dobson, denouncing Pat Robertson, and basically revealing all the things that his father had said about these people. His father called them the low IQs, because, you know, as Frank Schaefer told me, they worship ignorance. So it's really encouraging to see what he's doing. But it's a sad story because, as he told me, you know, my father created a monster, and it was too late for him to stop it or put it back in the cage.
So what happened to the moral majority? They eventually fell from power.
The moral majority was sort of identified as the Christian right, and a lot of reporters would refer to the moral majority as synonymous with the Christian right. Same with the Christian Coalition. The Christian Coalition in the 80s and in the 90s, the group that Pat Robertson founded and that Ralph Reed headed, was synonymous with the Christian right. And I think the media missed the story that the movement had become atomized and was developing leadership outside of, you know, and growing more and more extreme and more effective outside their view. I think the media was derelict on the Christian right until the Terri Schiavo affair. So the moral majority disbanded eventually, and Jerry Falwell moved on and I think passed on the leadership initially to Pat Robertson and the Christian Coalition, but it really fell to James Dobson, who's a central figure in my book, to bring the Christian right into the 21st century. And it was Dobson who I think is directly responsible for the re-election of George W. Bush and the rise of the Republican Congress of Tom DeLay, the most radical and also the most corrupt Congress in American history.
So talk about James Dobson. Where did he come from and how did he rise to power?
Yeah, James Dobson is a fascinating figure because he, unlike Falwell and Robertson, is not a preacher, although people in the press mistakenly call him Reverend Dobson. He has no religious credentials. He never studied theology. He's a child psychologist who made his fame and fortune writing a book called Dare to Discipline, which is a manual for basically beating your child into submission in order to restore respect for that, for authority and God in that child. It was written right after the 60s, and Dobson counterposed himself to Dr. Benjamin Spock, who he called the father of permissiveness. Dobson understands, I think, the culture of the Christian right at a more intimate level than Robertson or Falwell because he's a psychologist. He understands that behind the politics of resentment and behind the histrionics, behind the culture war, is a culture of personal crisis. So he started Focus on the Family, this group in Colorado Springs, to exploit that fact. His correspondence department in Colorado Springs handles so much mail and so many letters and phone calls from, you know, average workaday middle Americans seeking help for mundane problems, from their child's bedwetting problem to marital strife to adultery to pornography addiction, that it has its own zip code in Colorado Springs. And when people write in, they'll receive some Dobson-approved advice offering them some fairly conservative prescriptions for their problems. But what ultimately happens is they're entered in a database and they're bombarded with political mailings telling them that the homosexual agenda and abortion and liberalism and feminism are the root of these problems. that we live in a fallen society, and once we rid our society of these problems, we'll be in a utopia and you won't be experiencing these personal crises. And so through this system, Dobson transforms crisis-racked, traumatized people into Republican shock troops, and they reward him with their total fealty, with somnambulistic devotion. They see him as their magic helper. You know, he's this leader who provided them with a glorious cause and symbols that lifted them from the drudgery of their lives and from the trauma they were experiencing. And so there are very few leaders in American life who can command a following the way Dobson does. And I know this because I participated in a campaign to expose some of Dobson's schemes with the Republican Congress. There were ads run in Colorado Springs and Washington, and my role was basically just to talk about who Dobson was to the Colorado media when they became interested in the campaign. And so I fell onto Dobson's radar, and his political lieutenants identified me on air as, you know, one of their enemies. And suddenly I was bombarded with 7,000 hate mails in my public email box in 1 week. 7,000. Most of them were telling me how Dobson had, you know, some people were calling him Saint Jim Dobson. Some people told me his focus is on helping families. He helped my family. How dare you lie this way? Etc., etc. But it showed how Dobson can merely flick a switch and command his army to target one person who they never heard of before, who's sort of an insignificant investigative journalist. And they will, they'll do whatever he wants. So imagine if I was a senator or a federal judge or something like that, someone who's more in the public eye. The response is that much more intense. That's how Dobson was able to derail the career of Bob Dole, who refused to let Dobson and his lobbyist at the time, Gary Bauer, set his agenda during the 1996 presidential campaign. It's how Dobson was able to destroy the political ambitions of Colin Powell, who wanted to run for president in 1996 and was the most popular Republican politician at the time, a Republican figure. But he refused to adopt a pro-life, anti-abortion position. It's how Dobson was able to destroy Newt Gingrich when Gingrich failed with impeachment at President Clinton and also failed to restrain himself from having an affair with a woman 20 years his junior who was on the congressional payroll. So even Newt Gingrich wasn't conservative enough for Dobson. His other problem with Gingrich was that the Contract for America contained no mention of abortion or homosexuality. So through this army of belt-wielding, crisis-racked people that Dobson commands, he helped destroy the moderate Republican establishment and turn the big tent party of Dwight Eisenhower, that Dwight Eisenhower once led, into the one-ring circus of George W. Bush, Tom DeLay, and Sarah Palin.
So, do you believe that Dobson actually subscribes to the different ideas and values that he is pushing on his listeners?
Dobson is a true believer. He's not in it for the money, although he is in it for the power. Francis Schaeffer always said that about Dobson, that he was obsessed with power, he was a megalomaniac. But he genuinely believes in what he's saying, although he needs to affect image of being above politics. I had to listen to his show every day for Media Matters for America, the progressive media monitoring group in Washington, which is sort of a dubious job because while I learned a lot, I also learned a lot about my own intestinal fortitude. And Dobson would consistently say, I do not lead a political organization. This isn't politics, while he was pushing people to, you know, contribute to some cause or, you know, flood the phone lines of some insufficiently conservative senator. So in order to, affect, he needs to seem above politics and deny that he is, you know, lock, stock, and barrel in bed with the Republican Party. Because his flock likes to believe that they're just the pro-family movement. They're not allied with any political party, and that, you know, if they can work with a Democrat, they'll do that. But when George W. Bush became president And Dobson saw his role in making Bush president. He saw himself as a kingmaker. He became compromised, I think. And when Karl Rove called Dobson and said, "We want to appoint Harriet Myers as Supreme Court Justice." She was Bush's longtime lawyer from Texas, and it was just a classic example of conservative cronyism. She had no qualification to be Supreme Court Justice, and beyond that, had no conservative credentials. It was unclear whether she even was a culture warrior, that like Samuel Alito or John Roberts. It was unclear where she stood on abortion or homosexuality. And Dobson agreed. He gave his consent and went on the air and told his listeners, "We need to support Harriet Myers." But he refused to say why. The real reason was Karl Rove put in this call and said, "You know, you're working with us now." And that was, I think, a turning point for the Christian right, when a lot of the followers began to become demoralized because they had become integrated into the Republican Party. The Republican Party was little more than a host body for them, and they had become corrupted and compromised by power.
So do you have a sense for how many influential leaders Dobson has sought out versus how many have sought his help?
I can't quantify that, but you know, when you command you know, an organization that has consistently $150 million in its coffers, when you have 36 policy councils in the states, when you have 3.5 million members, when you have one of the top five radio shows in the country, and when you have affiliate organizations in five continents, politicians are going to seek you out. I mean, we saw what Jim Jones and the People's Temple was able to do in San Francisco. I mean, he was a well-known lunatic, but, you know, they gave him positions on, I think, the housing board. I mean, imagine that on a national level. And Dobson's followers do believe in him as if he were a cult leader. So, you know, what you see beyond politicians seeking him out is politicians actually becoming his followers. For example, Tom DeLay used to be known as Hot Tub Tommy in Texas. He was this philandering, drunk, no-name right-wing legislator, kind of a backbencher, who was known for these long, rambling speeches that, you know, bored everyone to death. His primary cause was opposing the EPA because he was a pest exterminator. And he lived in a place called Macho Manor with a bunch of bachelors and would sleep with women other than his wife. And when he was elected from Sugar Land, Texas, to the U.S. Congress, to the House, he discovered a video by Dobson that a congressman named Frank Wolf was showing in the Capitol basement. And he knew what Tom DeLay was about, knew that he was out drinking all night. And he said, "Why don't you watch this video, Where's Dad?" which is about spending more time with your children and family. And Dobson sings into the camera, "The Cat's in the Cradle," you know, this corny song. And when Dobson sang that and Tom DeLay was watching it in this darkened room, he broke down in tears and changed immediately. He snapped, as they say, as cult researchers say, he snapped. And he became the Hammer, this hardcore dominionist Christian legislator with a dictatorial tendency that went far beyond Newt Gingrich's authoritarian tendencies. And he was Dobson's man. And Dobson used him, as I said before, to take out Newt Gingrich. They had several coup attempts against Gingrich and Dick Armey that eventually succeeded with a vote of no confidence on Gingrich. DeLay was installed as Speaker, and Dennis Hastert became the majority leader, and Hastert was basically just a tool for the Hammer. DeLay hung up bullwhips on his wall in his office to symbolize his dictatorial reign over the House. And he tried to corral all of the lobbyists from K Street into his agenda through the K Street Project, which was funded with Jack Abramoff's casino money. And it all wound up basically bringing down the Republican Congress when it was revealed that DeLay had produced the most corrupt Congress in history, that he was indicted for money laundering. And his approval rating dropped in his district, one of the most Republican districts in the country, to the point where it appeared that a Democrat would beat him. And all of this led to the Terry Schiavo charade, which is just an episode that DeLay and Dobson and others in the radical Republican Congress exploited to ramp up this their demoralized Christian base for one last glorious crusade.
We are talking with Max Blumenthal. He is author of the new book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Let's continue talking about James Dobson. He actually took advantage of a local person, Ted Bundy. Talk about that, and maybe start with Ted Bundy himself, because I didn't realize before reading your book that he actually had some significant connections to the local Republican Party here for a while.
Right, right. I really think there could be a movie about this. I mean, I saw the Bundy movie, and it completely glossed over the politics and Dobson. And it's one of the, I think, the most fascinating stories in recent history. Bundy was, like Dobson, interested in psychology. He, I think, was studying to be a psychologist at the University of Washington, and he was working at nights at a rape crisis hotline in Seattle. There's a great book about him by Anne Rule called The Stranger Beside Me, and she worked beside him at this rape crisis hotline and saw he was actually very skilled in counseling rape victims, and he created a pamphlet for women to prevent them from getting raped with that was a state-funded pamphlet. Really bizarre. At the same time, he was interested in Republican politics, and he became involved with the campaign of Dan Evans, a moderate Republican candidate for governor nicknamed the Straight Arrow. And Bundy was his personal driver, and he was also his top opposition researcher. Bundy would put on a wig and a mustache, and he'd slip into rallies of Evans' opponent, Albert Rossellini, the Democrat, and film him using different inflections and accents before different audiences. And then they put together Bundy's footage that he shot on camera on secret, hidden cameras, into an ad that supposedly revealed Rossellini as this limousine liberal faux populist, like the classic phony liberal. And it was, these ads were devastating. Evans went on to win. Bundy would babysit Evans' kids. He was voted Mr. Republican or Republican of the Year by the state Republican Party. He was best friends with the assistant director of the Republican Party of Washington. No one knew that he was also wearing those same disguises from his Oppo research days to capture, kill, and rape women, possibly 130 women. He was finally captured, and after escaping from prison twice, was taken to the electric chair in Stark, Florida, the federal penetentiary there. He'd killed several people in Florida, and he decided while he was on death row, while on death row, became captivated with report that Dobson and several other of his Christian right allies had written, the Meese Commission on Pornography report, 1,000 pages of explicit descriptions of pornography, with their opinions on how pornography damages individuals, and along with recommendations that all pornography be banned, including softcore pornography, and that vibrators be banned as well. This book was what Bundy was reading on death row, while a man named John Tanner, a good friend of Dobson's, who is now, I think, the DA in Daytona Beach, would pray with Bundy. He became his spiritual advisor, and was trying to negotiate to keep Bundy alive while he was converting Bundy into a born-again Christian and convincing him that, he could go to heaven even after all he had done. Bundy, who was a pathological liar and a sociopath, decided that he would make one last publicity coup and that he would confess to Dobson in an exclusive interview, or tell Dobson in an exclusive interview, that the reason that he felt compelled to kill so many women and rape them, including raping their dead bodies, was because he saw images from Playboy magazines as a young boy, and it was all the fault of pornography. And Dobson leapt at the opportunity to make Ted Bundy a poster child for his movement. So he, the killer and the saint in the Valley of Death, had this interview for an hour. No other media were allowed into the prison. They were all outside in this, famous spectacle where people were cheering for Bundy to fry. And Dobson came out with tapes of the interview. The media was flocking around him, and he negotiated the terms right there. that they would have to show the full hour interview on national TV, unedited, unexpurgated, and uninterrupted by commercials. So Dobson was able to, you know, vault into the national conscience and become this huge public figure no one, you know, secular America had never heard of, because they were forced to watch him for an hour in this interview that they, you know, were captivated by. He also sold tapes of that interview to his followers and made $1 million. And when controversy ensued, Dobson said, "I'm donating those tapes to, you know, charities, to nonprofit charities. They are actually anti-abortion groups he donated the profits to that were affiliated with his political empire." So through Bundy, Dobson was able to leverage Bundy for influence and fame. And he went on to do the same thing with David Berkowitz, the son of Sam. And he was selling tapes of his interview with Berkowitz for $7 on his website. And when the New York Board of Corrections said, "This is appalling. How could a church group sell interviews of this notorious killer and, you know, make a profit from him talking about how he's a born-again Christian now and, you know, he's a new man," or as Dobson called him, the son of hope. Dobson marked up the tapes for $2 more and is now selling them for $9 on his website. So there is a cynicism there. But the point I make in my book is that whether you're a killer or whether you're a Republican leader, as long as you subscribe to, you know, Dobson's rigid demands, he'll treat you the same, and he'll treat you like he'll go to bat for you. He'll welcome you into his empire, and he will insulate you from the criticism of secular society, no matter what you've done. And he used the same methods to convert Ted Bundy as he did to convert Tom DeLay.
No matter what you've done or what you continue to do?
Well, I mean, he'll take you at your word, no matter what you say. And precisely, I mean, Tom DeLay was arguably more corrupt and more criminal after encountering Dobson and after encountering this dominionist way of life. It gave him the sense that anything... I met Tom DeLay, actually, at the Christians United for Israel convention in 2006 in Washington. This is a group of end-timers, people who believe that all the Jews have to go be gathered into Israel to fulfill biblical prophecy. And then, of course, in the end, they'll burn in an everlasting lake of fire. But it's Pastor John Hagee's group, and they believe in, you know, the book of Revelations. They're lusting for Armageddon. Tom DeLay was there because he apparently believes in this too. He told me, "Yeah, I can't wait for the rapture to happen." And it was sort of surreal talking to someone who ran Congress for so long telling you that. And I said, "What do you think of the charges against you, the indictment in Texas for money laundering?" And he said, "Well, Satan is behind those charges." And I said, "What about your critics?" He said, "Satan is behind the left." So, I mean, if you can write everything off as a satanic plot, it's very difficult to be self-reflective or to be to hold yourself accountable for what you've done. And that's the mentality of Tom DeLay and so many other people who I think shattered the Republican Party. The failure to know their limitations or be self-reflective is in so many ways rooted in the sensibility that Dobson and the movement leaders cultivated, the idea of a battle between Satan and God, a spiritual war, a Manichaean struggle between light and dark. If you see the world that way, it's very difficult to experience nuance or take responsibility for the complexities of your own actions.
Is Dobson's group and the movement synonymous with the dominionist?
Well, dominionism is really just the idea of taking back America for Christ, whatever that means. And it could be a soft theocracy, it could be a total theocracy, but dominionism is just the concept of influencing the culture and politics to take on a more Christian, to be more Christian, more biblical, to insert biblical law through even stealth means into public policy, and to use politics to do it. So, you know, there are those who believe that, who are dominionists who believe that Christ could come back at any day, the rapture could happen at any time, like Pastor Hagee, who I mentioned, who endorsed John McCain in 2008. And then there are those who, and there are many, the fewer of these type of people, but like the followers of R.J. Rush Dooney, the founder of Christian Reconstructionism, who I talk about in my book, who believe that Christians, evangelicals, have to take back America and install a reign of biblical law for 1,000 years before Christ comes back. In other words, the environment has to be conditioned for his return. And this is much less popular because it has less emotional appeal, because you're not looking for signs and dispensations of Christ's return, and you don't feel like it'll happen in your lifetime. It's so much more incremental, and so this tends to attract a more intellectual and, I think, eccentric contingent.
Do you believe Rush Dooney's works influenced Dobson?
I have no way of knowing, but I do know of some people he's influenced directly, like who've been involved with Dobson, like Howard F. Amundson Jr., who is the sugar daddy of the Christian right. And I was the first reporter in 15 years to interview Amundson. He doesn't speak to the press because he has Tourette's syndrome, and he is just a very traumatized person. When Amundson was 18, he inherited $300 million from his father, Howard Amundson Sr., the great man of California, the great philanthropist who founded Washington Mutual. His father was dead, his mother died soon after, and he's left alone in a mansion. And he goes crazy, literally. And some people say, Amundson, he's a wacko. Well, I mean, it's almost objectively true. He spent 2 years in the Menninger Clinic, and when he came out, he, you know, bounced around Europe for a while, pretending he didn't have all this money, pretending he didn't have a trust fund. And finally he was deeply ashamed of being wealthy and experiencing pangs of self-loathing. And he met Rush Dooney while in California. And Rush Dooney became his surrogate father and instilled in him all these dominionist beliefs. And in return, Amundson became Rush Dooney's sugar daddy. And in 1985, Amundson declared, "My goal is the total integration of biblical law into our everyday lives." So Amundson has funded, you know, so many initiatives of the Christian right. Right here in Seattle, he put up $1.5 million for the Discovery Institute's intelligent design program, the seed money. Then he put up $2.8 million for the wedge strategy, basically the political strategy to insert intelligent design into public school biology classrooms, which is basically inserting creationism, but under the guise of just providing an alternative to the theories of Darwin that really haven't been proven, in their words. But of course, what theory has been proven? That's why it's a theory. He also most recently funded, was one of the leading individual funders, along with Elsa Brookwiesen, the mother of Blackwater founder Eric Prince, of Proposition 8 in California. And Brookwiesen is close friends with Dobson. And Focus on the Family was also funding Proposition 8. This is the ballot measure that bans same-sex marriage in California. So all of these things that Amundson does, while he has sort of renounced some of Rush Dooney's teachings, like the execution of homosexuals, disobedient children, blasphemers, and witches, are influenced by the Christian Reconstructionist mindset of Rush Dooney. Banning same-sex marriage, intelligent design, is all designed to bring the United States closer to a theocracy. Whether they get there or not is beside the point.
Currently in this election cycle, we have someone from the Discovery Institute that's running for the executive of King County, the county we are
really
in, Susan Hutchinson, a former TV broadcast personality.
Well, the Discovery Institute does, they work on transportation. They do a lot of different things. It's the intelligent design wing that Amundson funds, and that's headed by Bruce Chapman, who's a former Reagan administration official and a former ambassador to Austria. And he's also been involved with Amundson in the campaign to divide the mainline Episcopal Church. Really interesting character. I think The Stranger profiled him and concluded that Amundson's money was what was really driving Chapman. But just to add, I think Amundsen's involvement with the Discovery Institute is a taint, and anyone who affiliates themselves with the Discovery Institute now, it should be held responsible for not opposing this, not publicly denouncing it, or not leaving. And so this Kings County candidate needs to be held accountable.
Talk about how this movement ties into the rise of Sarah Palin, her power base.
Well, in the 2008 primary campaign, there was no clear favorite in the Republican field, although everyone had written off Mike Huckabee before his campaign was even started. But Huckabee comes from the Christian right. His famous line before audiences of evangelicals was, "I'm not coming to you, I come from you." He's an ordained Baptist minister, close friend of James Dobson. His favorite book is Francis Schaeffer's Christian Manifesto, where Schaeffer sort of suggests that Christians should use domestic terrorism. And he also had this affable character and played bass and hung out with Chuck Norris, who is a hardcore Christian dominionist who's still beloved by secular America. So he had the goodwill of the press. He wound up crushing Mitt Romney in Iowa, who was spending $8 million a day on negative ads. And by doing so, Huckabee and Romney split the conservative base and cleared space for John McCain to emerge, who was detested by all factions of the conservative movement. But Republican voters had decided to vote tactically. They thought with McCain's career of public service and his reputation and the goodwill of the Washington Press Corps, which lavished McCain with praise, that he would be the best candidate to defeat either Hillary or Obama. When McCain, took the nomination, he realized that he had to pick a vice president who would appeal to Christian right sensibilities. And Dobson went on his radio show and said, "I cannot vote for McCain. He's basically a liberal. He may be even more liberal than Obama, but we'll be watching to see what vice president he picks." And Dobson had been corresponding with someone that mainstream America and the press corps had never heard of, Sarah Palin, in the wilds of Alaska. He was sending her letters, commending her for having what he called that little Down syndrome baby, as a statement of her values. As a statement of her pro-life commitment, she didn't abort a child with Down syndrome. And he began promoting her to the Republican grassroots, to the Christian right, while William Kristol, the columnist from the Weekly Standard, promoted her to the Beltway Republican establishment. So John McCain selected Palin. It was supposed to be this maverick move, but really it was just another sop to the Christian right the Republican Party was throwing, because it's completely controlled by this movement. And Dobson went on his show and gave McCain his full-throated endorsement. I had heard at meetings of there was a Christian right kind of gathering of the whole cabal, all the funders and the top activists and leaders, including Dobson and his allies in St. Paul, where the Republican convention was hosted, and they were literally jumping up and down and standing on chairs cheering when they heard Palin was announced and saw her speech accepting the nomination. Palin is the archetype of the right-wing woman, and while she was mocked for having a daughter who was pregnant at the age of 16 out of wedlock, while she herself advocated abstinence education and called herself a hardcore pro-lifer, that is something that is quintessential to the sensibility of the Christian right. If you look at the facts on the ground in Palin country, you'll see that so many people, so many evangelical women are going through the same struggles. Look at Lubbock, Texas, where abstinence-only education has been mandated since 1996. And the rate of gonorrhea infections among adolescent girls is twice the national average. If you look at a study by the sociologists Hannah Bruckner and Peter Bierman showing that communities that have purity balls, which are where evangelical adolescent girls pledge to stay pure until marriage and then dance with their fathers in a prom-like ceremony, and their fathers put rings on their fingers. Those girls who put white flowers at the bottom of crosses pledging to stay pure are deflowered soon after, and those communities have higher rates of STDs than communities that do not host purity balls. That's according to a new study by congressional study by AdHealth, this congressionally funded group shows that evangelical white women lose their virginity at a younger age than any demographic besides black Protestant women. So you can see why so many people would identify with Palin on a level that transcends politics, that transcends ideas, and transcends ideology. It's a visceral personal identification that goes to the culture of personal crisis that I talk about in my book that lurks behind the politics of resentment. When Palin, and Palin was also very glamorous. I mean, the spending of hundreds of thousands of dollars on clothes was, you know, not just, was, I think, calculated. And, you know, she's giving glamour to a movement that's always been mocked by secular America, that's always been mocked by the media. Her anti-intellectualism, while that, you know, drove the McCain-Palin ticket down. She couldn't even cite the name of one magazine she read. She was terrible in interviews with the secular media. People in the Christian right identified with this and even admired her for being unapologetically anti-intellectual. She embodied the know-nothingism of the movement, the belief that the secular media was against them no matter what, that these pencil-necked bureaucrats and intellectuals in Washington and New York and Hollywood were against them no matter what. I remember going to a rally for Palin at the Republican convention, outside the convention at a hotel, and it was by a group called Republican Feminists for Life, which is basically feminists against feminists. And this right-wing radio host, Laura Ingraham, who graduated from Dartmouth University, who'd lived the life of an elitist, and whose openly gay brother refused to talk to her anymore, was speaking, and she was mocking all of Palin's critics, saying they're elitists, these people are the Hollywood liberal elite, and they think that they're so smart because they have so many stamps on their passport, because Palin was mocked for having never left the country except once when she went to Kuwait. And I mean, and she you know, the gales of applause went through the crowd when Ingraham said this. It's a movement that actually celebrates the idea of not traveling to foreign countries. It's a movement that worships the past and worships ignorance. And I mean, with Barack Obama running on the Democratic ticket, it was a movement that would inevitably demonize him for having multicultural roots and having relatives from other countries. I think the hatred we're seeing to Obama just grew out of the nomination of Palin and the celebration of Palin and the movement that surrounded her.
So do you have a sense, numbers-wise, how many people we're talking about in this movement?
Well, it could be just as little as 12%. The thing is, you look at the outpouring of support for Barack Obama during his campaign. I knew so many people who volunteered for him. And then as soon as he was inaugurated, they thought that they had ushered in utopia and went back to their lives. They're not even following politics anymore. But the Christian right, while it's consistently written off, is working day and night. They're voting in school board elections. They're voting for county clerk. They're voting at the lowest level. And they're training their activists to take over the school board, but to move from there into a higher position until they reach the U.S. Senate. Every election to them is a chance to move the country closer to their goal, to move it closer to a Christian republic that they believe the country was actually founded on. They're trying to bring Jesus back ultimately, one way or another. They're trying to bring Jesus back into America. They're hoping for the rapture. Liberals are hoping for the public option. So they may be 12%, but they're always going to, exert an influence that's completely disproportionate to their numbers.
The subtitle of your book, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, define that. Is the Republican Party no more as it once was, or have they completely taken over this party?
Well, the party can always come back, and it could easily win 10, 20, 35 seats in 2010 in the House. If Obama's health care plan fails, or if he passes a bill with mandates in it and no public option, that's what they're angling for. But at the same time, if you look at the approval rating of congressional Republicans across the country, you'll see how the party's been shattered. In the Northeast, the approval rating of congressional Republicans is 7%. In the Midwest, it's 20%. And in the West, it's 21%. But in the Deep South, it's 60%. This is the party of Representative Joseph Wilson, the party of You Lie. It's a neo-Confederate party that can only really hold power in mostly white, mostly evangelical sections of the country, many of which are depopulated. And so in that respect, I think the party's been shattered because it's been captured by those elements. All of the moderates are gone. Christy Todd Whitman, the former governor of New Jersey and one-time EPA chief under George W. Bush, wrote a book, a wrongly titled book, called It's My Party Too. You know, she's from the famous moderate Republican Party, Republican family, the Whitmans, and she pointed out a really interesting fact that John McCain, who was seen as a moderate, won in 2008 3% more conservative Republican votes than of conservative Republican voters than George W. Bush did, who was a hardcore conservative, 85% rating from the American Conservative Union. At the same time, McCain lost. He received 20% less moderate Republican votes than Bush did when Bush ran in 2004, and McCain was always seen as a moderate Republican, a maverick, which means that the moderates had gone over to the Democratic side and had voted for Barack Obama and Democrats in Congress. So for now, the moderates have completely left the Republican Party, and I see no effort among Republicans to go through a rebuilding process or to get the radical elements out. Instead, they're pandering to the teabagger movement. They're pandering to Glenn Beck. They're speaking at, these Tea Party rallies. Chuck Grassley, the ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, who's in charge of negotiating Barack Obama's health care plan out of Congress, has echoed Sarah Palin in saying that this plan includes a provision for death panels that will pull the plug on grandma. You know, these hysterical claims that have emerged from the teabagger movement are being echoed at the highest levels of the Republican Party. And meanwhile, the so-called moderates, Mitt Romney or John McCain, are silent and will not say anything to challenge this base. So the party faces a terrible quandary that I think will produce, in the end, a major conflict, possibly the end of the Republican Party as we know it. But for now, they're going to keep losing on a national level, unless the Obama administration implodes or continues this, in this belief that they can compromise with Republicans and work together to produce some kind of post-partisan era, which I think is a total fantasy. And if Obama would read my book, he'd see that.
What is this movement's ties to or beliefs in regards to corporate America, the large corporations? Because they seem to have gotten a good conduit amongst major media outlets like Fox, and obviously Dobson has his own radio outlet. So why is corporate America, giving them a free ride, basically?
Well, it's tragic that so many of these people's lives are affected by corporate America negatively. I mean, their resentment of pornography, including the softcore pornography you see on MTV. I mean, I can relate to that because, I don't have any children, but if I did, I wouldn't want my children seeing the kind of trash that's on MTV. And you can understand that, they don't want, for example, their children to be seeing online porn, but there's no way to stop it. So the American Family Association, which is a major Christian right group out of Mississippi, they're one of the their top means of fundraising is by selling a porn filter, a computer porn filter, and they run ads on Christian radio saying, "Save your marriage with our porn filter." You know, it's that much of a problem. Stop web cheating. And this is the result of corporations. The corporate ravaging of middle America, but their leadership refuses to take it on. Instead, their leadership emulates corporate America and often does the bidding of corporate America, including the healthcare industry. And Dobson's been a longtime opponent of universal Medicare, and him and Tony Perkins from the Family Research Council, his lobbyist in Washington, have been running ads claiming Obama's health care plan will force taxpayers to pay for abortion. You know, I talk in my book about how they have this crisis industry, the Christian right, and they exploit personal crises for political gain. And they think the church is the only means of resolving all the trauma and anxiety in middle America. So if the government was able to come in and resolve some of these crises and help people, especially, you know, the crises that stem from healthcare costs and sickness, that would be a huge threat to them and their ability to evangelize and to win more shock troops for their political agenda. So there's that, and you know, also within the teabagger movement, I covered the 9/12 rally on the National Mall, and you know, I have a video called the Unauthorized Teabagger Tour, which you can see at my blog, maxblumenthal.com. And I interviewed so many people there who don't have health care, who are just one accident away from being completely bankrupted, but they're rallying against having health care. And who paid for that rally to happen? Who promoted it? Who's astroturfing all of the tea parties? It's Dick Armey, the former Republican House Majority Leader, who is now a corporate lobbyist, who is completely funded. His group Freedom Works is funded by the healthcare industry. So basically, corporate America, while it's exploiting and hurting middle America, and creating more resentment among them, unwittingly, though they don't understand the source of it, they blame liberalism, is also shepherding them to these rallies and using them as useful tools for the corporate agenda. And I think it's sort of pathetic and sad to watch. And when you confront the followers about it, they're unable to reflect on what's going on. It stops the euphoria of the cause that they're involved in to even reflect on who Dick Armey is and who's actually puppeteering them.
So do you have a sense for what we in this country can expect in the coming election cycle, and what do you see as solutions?
I really think it comes down to the healthcare debate and Obama's healthcare reforms. If he can pass a bill with a public option, the Democrats can hold Congress and he can save his first term. I think regardless of what happens, he's going to win a second term, but he could be completely neutered if the Republicans win the 35 seats that they're targeting in the House of Democrats who've been elected from moderate to conservative districts. So I would just watch what's going on with health care. The Republicans are determined to tear it down by any means. Although I talked to a friend who's a major conservative radio host who told me what they really want is to have a bill pass, but a bad bill, so they can keep, you know, mobilizing hatred of Obama and while still giving him the success they need to present him as a powerful enemy. As far as the Republican Party is concerned, they're going to continue to pander to their base. They're not any moderate who comes out, or anyone who comes out and denounces Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh will be beaten down. I mean, you saw 2 weeks ago Rush Limbaugh suggesting that perhaps we should have segregated school buses. And, this is, just a month or two before, Michael Steele, the African-American chairman of the Republican National Committee, had gone on Rush Limbaugh's show to apologize to him for calling him an entertainer. I mean, this is the dynamic that's destroying the Republican Party like a cancer. No one can take on Rush Limbaugh. Mitt Romney and Bobby Jindal and Haley Barbour, three governors who are going to be front runners in the 2012 campaign, tried to form a new group. I think it was called the National Association for a New America, something like that. And they advertised a listening tour they were going to go on their website, along with a program, sort of like the Contract for America, their new program for America. It contained no mention of abortion or homosexuality. And so they came under immediate attack from Tony Perkins and Rush Limbaugh. And they scrubbed their program from the website and didn't go on their listening tour. That's, you know, that's another example of when you have a losing team, you either go through a rebuilding process or you double down and fail on the basis of your old veteran talent. And that's the Republican Party has chosen to double down on Sarah Palin and double down on James Dobson and Rush Limbaugh because they have no other way of they have no other base to go to. So it's a major quandary. And the Democrats can continue to win because of the weakness of the Republicans, but they can't pass any productive legislation unless they're willing to adopt a progressive agenda and stop this illusion of compromise.
Only got a couple minutes left. Where is James Dobson in his life cycle? Where do you see Focus on the Family going?
Well, I mean, he's resigned as the chairman of Focus on the Family and installed a former defense industry contractor who came out of the military, which shows you just another connection between the Christian right and corporate America. They're very tied into the military-industrial complex in Colorado Springs, where, you know, Northrop Grumman and I think Raytheon and a lot of these other companies are based. But this is a puppet who he's installed. He just wanted to take some of the workload off of himself because he's getting old and he's already had a heart attack. But Dobson remains in charge. All the advice that goes to the, you know, the members of Focus on the Family was written by Dobson. The whole empire is basically a cult that exists around Dobson's philosophies and teachings. And he remains, in front of the microphone every day at Focus on the Family Radio, one of the top five radio shows in the country. But the reason that I talk about Dobson in my book is, you know, beyond his political influence, just how he's cultivated the sensibility of the movement, how he's cultivated this mentality of how he's brought all these people who are in conflict with themselves into the party, and how they projected that conflict into the political arena and thrown the party in conflict with itself.
All right. With that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've just been talking with Max Blumenthal. He is author of the new book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. And you can find out more about his work via his website, maxblumenthal.com.